From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This past weekend, San Diego played host, as it does every year, to Comic-Con International. It's the largest pop culture convention in North America. Comic-Con began more than 40 years ago, focusing on comics and science fiction. Now it features everything, from the producers of the TV show Glee to Francis Ford Coppola to panels of librarians. For the past 10 years, the closing panel has taken Comic-Con back to its sci-fi roots. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS was in the house this year for Starship Smackdown.
Football fans have the Super Bowl. Soccer fans have the World Cup. Sci-fi geeks have Starship Smackdown.
Well, I mean, Starship Smackdown says it all, doesn't it, guys? I mean, it's the ultimate conflagration of starships.
Mark A. Altman, creator of the Cinemax show Femme Fatale, says Starship Smackdown answers the continual debate geeks have about whether the Enterprise would kick the Millennium Falcon's butt in a space rumble.
We only allow real starships to participate. No cartoons, no animated characters. Only real spaceships participate in the fight.
Here's how it all goes down. Hundreds of people pack into a meeting room. Then, expert panelists and avid fans, some even sporting their team logos, suggest ships that fill up the brackets, kind of like in March Madness.
We will have the original Battlestar Galactica and the new Battlestar Galactica.
Panelists have to be savvy on everything from Star Trek to Star Wars to Serenity, from H.G. Wells to H.R. Puffin stuff. Fans eagerly yell out their suggestions in the hopes of getting their favorite ship into the competition before the brackets close.
One at a time!
This year, fans threw the panel a curveball. They wanted one of the ships to be the Chevy Malibu from the trippy 80s cult film Repo Man.
Are you talking about the car in Repo Man? That's not a star. Well, it did fly away at the end, but we don't know where it went.
I gotta say.
It might have had a mothership, so it wouldn't have been a starship. It would have just been a surface-to-air transport.
You know what? Since it's the first time we've heard it, I think it's a valid entry.
Then the panel surprised fans by denying them a human captain. They put famous computers at the helm. This year, the infamous Windows 7 was loaded up on Deep Space Nine's USS Defiant.
Well, the Defiant immediately crashes on boot up.
This elicited cries of foul play from panelist Robert Hewitt Wolf, a sci-fi TV writer and producer.
The fix was in. Once they put the Windows 7 program onto the Defiant, there was no possible way it was going to win.
The winner of the 10th anniversary Starship Smackdown is none other than Starship of the Imagination, piloted by HAL. Thank you. We'll see you next year. Good job.
Fan Christine Rideout was upset that her beloved Deep Space Nine craft wasn't given a fair shake.
I'm very disappointed. I mean, they put Windows 7 on the Defiant? What the heck is that? We didn't have a chance after that. We just crashed.
Disappointment is just part of the game in this rough-and-tumble world of Starship Smackdown. Founder Mark Altman had his sights set on the Moonraker space shuttle, but was still happy with the final results.
It's such a delight to see people that we've seen over the last 10 years come back again and again and indulge this bit of insanity, this frivolous nonsense that we do every year.
Even though only one winner emerges victorious, the debate among geeks about which starship is truly the best will go on forever. For NPR News in San Diego, I'm Beth Accomando.
And today's last word in business is all that. That's the theme of the 1990s Nickelodeon TV show All That, a sort of Saturday Night Live for preteens. That show's core audience is now in its mid-20s, and Nickelodeon is tapping into their nostalgia for the good old days of the 90s. This week, the network's Teen Nick channel launched an after-midnight programming block called The 90s Are All That. New York Magazine reports its ratings are up 850%. Reruns of shows like Kenan and Kel and the cartoon Doug have become top trending topics on Twitter. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, ready for some football? The NFL lockout is over as team owners and player representatives have reached an agreement. We'll speak with Demora Smith, head of the NFL Players Association, about how it all came together and highlights of the deal from the players' perspective. That's coming up a little later in the program. But first, as President Obama and congressional leaders continue to try to come to agreement over federal spending and raising the debt ceiling to avoid default next week, A duo of prominent African-American commentators is saying, "Do not forget to watch out for the least of us." That, of course, is a biblical term, and that is the message that Princeton University professor Cornel West and radio host Tavis Smiley say they hope to send during their upcoming poverty tour. Beginning next Friday, the two plan to visit 16 cities to shine a spotlight on the needs of the poorest and most vulnerable Americans. Both Smiley and Cornel West have been outspoken critics of President Obama, saying his economic policies have failed poor people in general and Black people in particular. That's earned them a lot of attention in the media, but has also cost them support from some other African Americans. And Professor Cornel West joins us now to offer his perspective on all of this. He is an author and, of course, activist and professor of African American studies and religion at Princeton University. And he's joining us now from the studios on that campus. Professor West, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, what a blessing for you to have me. And I just congratulate you on Tell Me More, Tell Me More, Tell Me More.
Well, thank you for that. I just wanted to start out by talking about the tour that you and your friend and colleague Tavis Smiley are participating in. What do you plan to do exactly, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, actually, the idea that Tavis Smiley had his Smiley group executed, what we're trying to do is cast a limelight on, a spotlight on the plight of poor people, working people, accenting their humanity, their dignity, and their sense of resiliency. There's been a top-down, one-sided class war against poor and working people, and we want to accent the fight back. We want to accent the resistance. And look, for example, what's going on in Washington right now, though, Sister Michelle. Wall Street oligarchs and corporate plutocrats have checkmated both the White House and Congress. They're all debating about cuts, cuts, cuts. Who will give the biggest cuts? We have a choice between a Reid plan, which is one of milquetoast spinelessness, and we've got the Boehner plan, which is catastrophic mean-spiritedness, and that's the choice. Let's be honest. Let's tell the truth and acknowledge that we are in a profound crisis.
Well, but to that end, you just pointed out the fact that we are in a period of divided government here. Is this, in fact, President Obama's fault that he cannot achieve headway on some of the things that you care most about?
Well, I think the fault goes across the board. There's no doubt that the very short-sighted and aggressive, in some ways vicious, right-wing of the Republican Party has been so intransigent. But you see, part of the problem goes back 2.5 years ago, though, Michelle. You see that when President Obama had a chance to accent the plight of working people, of homeowners and poor people, if he had accented homeowners, if he had accented jobs, if he had accented working people's plight rather than Wall Street and rather than the corporate class, once he made that choice, he opened the gates for populist rage. That populist rage went right wing, translated into the Tea Party movement. Tea Party movement sends, what is it, about 80-some folk to Congress. They are the ones who have been standing in the way of any kind of compromise.
Well, to that end, and I do want to point out that you have criticized the president in rather personal terms, calling him the black mascot of Wall Street oligarchs, for example. But you don't seem to criticize Republicans in similarly personal terms, and some people wonder why that is.
Well, I mean, one is that when you talk about a president, you're talking about an individual. When you're talking about Tea Party members, you're talking about a whole collectivity. Secondly, I've had a relationship, very brief, with the president. I've had no relationship with the Tea Party movement. So
you feel personally betrayed?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. How could one not, if one sacrificed for a president who said he was going to build on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr.?
But to your point, your argument is that his failure, that the president and his administration's failure to make advances on economic concerns of the poor and the people who used to be middle class are the cause
exactly.
of the political backlash. Many people would say it's in fact the opposite, that the reason that there is a political backlash is precisely progressive moves like the health care bill. So what do you say to that? And you just disagree with that?
No, that's a plausible claim. It's just to make a priority on job creations, quality employment would have taken a lot of the real wind out of the sail of the Tea Party movement, because they began critical of Wall Street, and of course they, for the most part, are anti-government, and at the same time they do have elements that tend to demonize Brother Obama, President Obama.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Professor Cornel West. We're talking about his upcoming poverty tour, which he plans to take starting next week, along with talk show host Tavis Smiley, to highlight the needs of America's poor. We're also talking about some rather pointed criticisms that he has made of President Obama. Just as you've criticized President Obama, some prominent voices voices from within the African-American community have also been critical of you, as I'm sure you know. For example, radio host Tom Joyner in a blog post wrote saying that you, and along with your colleague Tavis Smiley, who's also a colleague, of course, and friend of mine, that your language has been disrespectful and that has given justification to those and enabled those who are disrespecting the president and denying him the legitimacy that he is owed in his office, in part because of his race. And in fact, that you're enabling a kind of a racist dialogue. I'd like to ask how you respond to that.
No, I think that Brother Tom's remarks are ridiculous, they're ludicrous, that the right wing doesn't need me to authorize their venom toward the president. They've been at it for a long time. When I talk about oligarchy, I mean, for example, you asked the president, and I appreciated the question that you asked the president quite directly. What does it mean to be a black mascot of oligarchs? Now, he didn't get a chance to answer your question because you remember you threw in the other question about do you have a special responsibility to black people? He hit the second part, not the first. To talk about oligarchy is not to talk about race for the most part. It's to talk about power in America. It's to talk about structural inequality in America. It's to talk about the role of corporations and the role of investment bankers in the shaping of U.S. domestic policy. That's the kind of discussion that we're talking about. Tom Joyner in saying that one ought to be silent and not critical of the president is just part of a backward-looking view that says that somehow all black folk ought to close ranks and in no way engage in criticism of a black president when we got our precious black babies, and I'm concerned with all babies of all colors, but black babies, what, 38% of our black babies living in poverty? 20% of all American babies living in poverty, the highest poverty rates we've had in decades, and we're not going to say a word? No, the legacy of Martin King was, I'm critical of black mayors, I'm critical of black governors, and now in this period, we're going to be critical of a black president. If Barack Obama put forward an anti-poverty program that highlighted the plight of black poor people and working people, I'd be with him 100%. It's a matter of principle.
Just to clarify for those who may not be aware of what you're talking about, in my interview with President Obama last week, I asked him about your criticism of him specifically, and I did ask him whether he felt he had a special responsibility to African Americans, and he said that, well, we can actually play his answer so people can hear what he had to say for themselves. Here it is.
I have a special responsibility to look out for the interests of every American. That's my job as President of the United States. And I wake up every morning trying to promote the kinds of policies that are going to make the biggest difference for the most number of people so that they can live out their American dream.
Is he wrong?
See, he didn't hit your first part. When you said we black mascot of Wall Street oligarchs, that's a different question than special responsibility for everybody. I'm saying that's not true. He has not made poor people a priority. The White House responded to Tavis Smiley and I last week after Jesse Washington's piece in AP and said they have made poor people a priority in this administration. I say that's a lie. I want to see the evidence. Let's argue the case out. It's not personal. Let's look at the evidence.
But speaking of arguing the case out and not making it personal, though, when you said, as you did in two interviews, that one of your criticisms of him is that he didn't return your phone calls and that you couldn't get a ticket to the inauguration with your mother and your brother, and you said that the guy who picks up my bags from the hotel has a ticket to the inauguration and you don't, and that is part of the criticism. Do you think that that detracts from your message, that it seems as though it's really more about egoism?
Well, no, but the point is that there's two different tracks here, though, Sister Michelle. One is the matter of evidence. If the White House says they've made poor people a priority, let's look at the evidence and see the tilt toward Wall Street oligarchs. That's a fact. That has nothing to do with personal relations at all. At the same time, when I was asked what is my personal relationship with the president, I talked about what I perceived to be a relative lack of decency of 65 events that I did for him and not a thank you. I think that's lack of decency. That is a personal truth. The first one is a political truth. The two are very different, but when I'm asked a question, I tell the truth about my personal relation. I tell the truth about policy. Let's make the case, where have poor people, where have working people been at the center of Obama's Democratic policy? That's in part one of the reasons why the right wing has been able to engage in this vicious kind of critique. And I protect the president against the right wing critiques, but I'm not going to protect the president when he fails to focus on poor and working people.
And finally, before we let you go, and I want to end where we began with the tour that you and Tavis Smiley are making next week, which is that I wonder whether the train has left the station, in the sense that if you feel that there have been 2.5 years of a failure to address the issues of poor people. And they're engaged in these heated negotiations right now over federal spending and the debt and so forth. And when you feel that the interests of poor people have gotten lost, why not go sooner? Why next week when this is the critical week? I'm wondering whether the train's left the station.
Well, I mean, maybe we should have done it 2 years ago. But, I mean, the thing is, Brother Tappas just came up with the idea a few days ago, and to be able to pull it off by August 6th. We're hitting 16 cities. We're beginning at Indian Reservation. We're going to hit our indigenous brothers and sisters. We're going to hit the brown barrios. We're going to hit our poor white brothers and sisters. We're going to hit the Asian poor. And, of course, we're going to be highlighting as well the black hoods and the black ghettos. But we've got to, it was as soon as we can do it, and we're highlighting this. This thing is going to go on and on into the election. We're going to listen. We're going to learn. But most importantly, we're going to cast a limelight. We want a national conversation about poor people and especially their precious humanity.
Cornel West is the class of 1943 professor in African American Studies and Religion at Princeton University. He was kind enough to join us from the studios there. He's also co-host, along with Tavis Smiley, of the public radio program Smiley and West. Professor West, thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thank you so very much. You stay strong.
This week, 3D Smurfs have invaded movie theaters across the country. Now, viewers of a certain age, taking children, maybe grandchildren, might recognize the voice of the white-bearded Papa Smurf. It belongs to Jonathan Winters, who also played Grandpa Smurf in the 1980s TV cartoon series. Jonathan Winters has practiced comedy for 60 years on radio, TV, nightclubs, recordings, and movies. Many comics, many, cite Jonathan Winters as their favorite comedian. So much so that in 1999, the Kennedy Center awarded him the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Pat Dahl talked to Jonathan Winters about what he does and where it comes from.
Jonathan Winters says he doesn't tell jokes.
I have always classified me as an actor-comedian, a humorist. I started out as an artist, and what I do is I do verbal paintings. I paint a picture. Hopefully you'll see the characters and understand what they're doing and what they're saying.
Like the proprietor of the used pet shop from a 1960 album.
I can give you that kangaroo over there for 10 and a half. Come all the way from Australia. Most of them do. I got him as far as Muncie, and he fell off a flat car and broke his tail. Now, you know, most of them sit back there on their tails like this. But this one, you got to lean him again some.
There's a little hint of danger in the idea of the maimed bargain animals, as with so many of his routines. That's the way it should be, Winters says.
I am dangerous.
Winters found a natural home on dangerous shows like Steve Allen's and Jack Parr's in the 1950s. Once Jack Parr handed Jonathan Winters a stick about 3 feet long and told him to make comedy.
Send in those big cats. Send in the smaller ones.
Winters turned the stick into more than a dozen skits. The Quicksilver improvisations, countless characters, and mercurial changes of expression and mood led people to call him a wacky genius. Winters often drew on his Ohio childhood for characters. He says he was a lonely child, that his parents either ignored him or belittled him, even after his success. He brought his mother, a radio professional herself, onto the Jack Parr show, thinking she would get a kick out of it.
And Jack said, "You got a hell of a talent here. You must be very proud of him." And my mother said, "He's the biggest joke I ever wrote." But they were both insanely jealous of my career.
At the height of his success in his early 30s, Winters voluntarily committed himself to a private psychiatric hospital.
At that time, they didn't have a label for me. I said, "What the devil? I know I'm not schizophrenic. I'm not catatonic. Why is it you don't have a label?" And the guy said, "It would only upset you." Well, I tell you what's upsetting me is the cost of this place.
Now his diagnosis is bipolar. But then they did not have effective medications for it. Winters declined electroshock treatment that doctors told him would erase some of the pain he was feeling.
I need that pain, whatever it is, to call upon it from time to time.
For his comedy. Winters even joked with the doctors treating him, the kind of joke that might prolong your stay.
I said to the guy, "You didn't ask me what I did in the Marines." And he said, "Okay, what'd you do?" I said, I was in demolition, and I have guys outside now in construction. I have contact with them. What's the story? Well, they would visit you. They would visit me? Yeah, there'd be just the one visit.
Winters left the hospital after 8 months. He, of course, used his breakdown in his comedy thereafter.
Said I was John Q from outer space, and left the mothership, and they caught me, you know. That was a terrible thing. But I had fun. It was interesting, you know, playing checkers all day and making rope-sole shoes and everything. Oh, crazy bet.
Jonathan Winters had his own TV comedy and variety show in the 1960s and 70s and regularly appeared in sitcoms, winning 2 Emmys. He won a 1995 Grammy for one of his recordings. His movies include The Slapstick Saga, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and the dark satire The Loved One, in which he played twin funeral home directors who schemed to launch the departed into orbit.
I tell you, Harry, this first resurrection has got to be perfect. How about a Nobel Prize winner, Herkovitz? Nobel, Schmobel, it's got to be national appeal, Harry.
Winters is 85 and says what gives him the most pleasure now is selling his colored pencil drawings, surreal sketches that always include eyes or coat hangers or fruit or stylized creatures. But he's also written a dramatic script for a Western, and he's working on his autobiography.
I chose this title I think works. It's me, and the title of the book is In Search of a Playground.
A place perhaps where a child with dangerous gifts might play to his heart's content. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
And that's music from It's a Mad, 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 Mad. How many mads are there? Mad World. And there is video of Jonathan Winters making comedy out of a stick on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.